I don't want to go into a long rap about what that all was, you know, what it was all about and the heavy psychological significance of it all, but mostly just to point out that the basic overall plan of showing something like that is the juxtaposition of what I would call like the plastic image of women and what I would think of more as a real image of what real women look like. And the interesting thing, since I helped collect a lot of the photographs that we used in that slideshow, is to find out that when you go through magazines, like all the popular magazines, newspapers, or wherever that you can find pictures of people in, that almost all the pictures that you can find of women are of the first category, what I would call plastic women, perfect women with perfect makeup and perfect dresses with never a wrinkle or a crease. And I think maybe perhaps that's one thing already that's indicative of what advertising is for women and what it tells us about ourselves and what it tries to accomplish. But I think what we want to do is try to understand that a bit, and that's what I'm here to try and do tonight. But first, what I had to do when I was sort of putting this together was try and figure out why we should talk about advertising at all. It seems to me that that's the place to start, since I was asking myself, why am I going through this hassle, right? And I was told by people who were organizing the course that I should be hard and be tough because this audience can take it, right? I thought, oh, well, that's fine. And then I had to try and figure out something that was hard and tough and that you could, you know, really take with all your newly acquired women's liberation muscles, and try and find something that was harder and tougher to take than the ads themselves, right? Because it seems to me that advertising says all that you have to say about advertising in one sense. In the sense that we know that they lie and they cheat and they'll do anything to sell a product, essentially. And that's part of what they're all about. And they do that so well, except that we know. And like, what's to say, you know? You disregard it. Because essentially, the way I sort of see advertising, it's like this continual assault on my sensibilities, if you like, on all of our sensibilities. In that you can't turn on the TV set, you can't pick up a newspaper, you can't look at a magazine, you can't listen to the radio, you can't even look at buses in the city streets without having all this garbage tossed at you, all these great ideas that essentially put women down. And sure, we're tough and we take it every day, right? We take the bombardment of ugliness, the plastic people, the Ken and the Barbie with bad breath and sour armpits and crotch rot, try that again, and my own Excedrin headache number 643. You know, we take all of that, and we understand behind all that ugliness is the whole thing about that we are supposed to buy. We are supposed to buy. You're ugly, the ads tell us. Buy some product and you will be beautiful. You're incomplete, the ads tell you. You know, buy something and it will make your life this vision of purple happiness. You're too good for all the other people. Buy a Cadillac or buy a Lincoln or buy something that will indicate that to everybody. But always the basic thing about that is to buy something. Okay, so we know all that, right? And so why do we have to sort of sit here and talk about that if we know it all already? So then we have to say, well, what about advertising? How important is it really? And does it create needs, which is one of the arguments that people put forward as one of the reasons why it's important? And where do women fit into advertising? Okay, so then what I did was I went and I tried to figure out what the advertisers themselves claim that they're doing and the value of advertising, right? And what they claim, which is on that handout in some part or other, is, and this is a quote, that advertising helps to reduce prices and spread the economy's goods to the impoverished millions. Right? You got that, eh? And so then I thought about that for a while, not very long. It didn't take me very long, but what I came up with on that was, you know, like the argument, right, is that they reduce prices Because by selling more, by advertising and then selling more, you increase the volume of production and the price goes down per unit, and therefore advertising is a good thing because it helps to increase consumption. Right? Right. Wrong. Because what they don't deal with is things like monopolies, and they don't deal with things like price fixing, so that we know that if Ford Motor Company puts up the price of new cars $100, so will Chrysler, so will General Motors, right? And so there ain't no competition, there ain't no sort of ability to discriminate on the part of the consumer, and the prices bear, in fact, very little relationship to that unit of the cost per unit of production, which may or may not be going down. In fact, there's some evidence to suggest that it is going down, and these corporations are simply making larger profits. However, that doesn't really reduce the price to us. And then spreading the riches, or spreading the goods, to the impoverished millions, and then you ask yourself, who are these impoverished millions? Are these Canadian Indians or Eskimos, or are they the impoverished, at least thousands on welfare, or old age pensioners, or women who are heads of families? Are these the impoverished millions that get all these goods because of advertising? I don't really think so. And I don't really think that the goodies are spread to the corners of the world, to where all the other impoverished millions in the third world are living either. So what we'd have to say about that kind of a claim for advertising is that it isn't true. And that isn't a surprising conclusion to come to when you're talking about advertising and what they say. Okay, so why does it exist? I suppose at the most simplistic level, you can say that for the ad agency, it's a living and it's a profit. And for the sponsor, it's a living and a profit. What they claim, oh, it's almost patriotic too, and this is really neat, because what they claim is that our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals. We need things consumed, burned up, thrown out, replaced and discovered at an ever-increasing rate. And so think about that for a minute. Who needs stuff consumed, used up, thrown away at an ever-increasing rate? Who profits from that? If you throw out your last year's winter coat, who profits when you go and buy a new one? Do you need to use that coat up, or do you need to waste it or destroy it or throw away? I don't really think so. And I don't think that that claim either is entirely true, although it has elements of truth in it, and we'll come back to that. But this is one of the places, this whole consumption thing, where advertisers see women as being really important. This is one of women's roles that they really love. And what it's called is woman as consumer, right? And they're right that the consumption of the production of this society is important, but it is only in a society like ours, where the labor force is so incredibly productive that that creates the kind of wealth that becomes a problem to distribute and use up. So that the problems of consumption as a way of life that they're talking about, you know, having to use up things, is only because we produce so much that the working people in this country and in the United States of America and the laboring class generally produce so much stuff that we have to use up. And I think that's really important to remember. And what that leads me to is to think that I want to talk about women and advertising from a specific perspective, which is to say that women are really, in fact, not as important as consumers as they are producers of wealth. And the kinds of things that I mean by that women should be seen as workers, as productive members of the society, and that the kinds of things that they do, the kinds of work that they accomplish, or the kinds of goods and services that they produce, are goods and services that are used in the home, right? The cooking of meals, the ironing of clothes, the mending, the maintenance of the home constitutes a whole body of goods and services that women, by and large, produce. Women are also engaged in reproduction in the home, which is, of course, the bearing and rearing of children, which will then constitute the next wave or the next generation of the labor force. And that's a very important task which somebody has to do, and it falls, generally speaking, on women. And then also women in the home function as I would call a reserve army of labor. That is to say, a reserve army of people who are presently unemployed outside of the home, but who in times of need can be mobilized out of the house and into the workforce, and then in times of less need, mobilized back into the home. Mother, your children need you now. And the classic example of that is women in wartime. And the kind of propaganda campaign that was put on, first to get women into the factories, you know, your country needs you, you've got to come out and your kids will be fine in daycare. And then when, at the end of the war, with soldiers returning and wanting their jobs back, it was a whole 10 to 15 year period of mother, your children needs you, you know, your children need you. And they need you from at least ages 1 to 6. Then women do have this function, right, as managers of the household, and that includes this whole thing on consumerism or on consumption. That is to say, the women, by and large, get to decide which brand of cat food or which brand of cereal or which deep freeze you're going to buy or which washer and dryer, and makes those kinds of decisions. And those are the ones that business is, you know, sort of concentrating our attention on. And I want to just, as an aside, point out that it's sort of interesting to notice how the nuclear family, the arrangement that we have of a nuclear family, really is a benefit to the economic system, capitalism, under which we live, because you have isolated families, each one of whom finds it necessary to own their own refrigerator, their own deep freeze, their own washer dryer, their own tea kettle, their own, you know, on and on and on and on. Which means that you can sell a lot more deep freezes, a lot more refrigerators, a lot more radios, TVs, color TVs, and on and on and on. You name it, and you can sell more of them if you have a situation where most people live in isolation from each other. And it leads one to suspect, getting back to the whole sort of patriotic theme, that if one person uses a vacuum cleaner, that's patriotic, folks. That's upholding the good old Canadian way. But if two people use it, that's almost subversive. So that's something to think about. They tell us, these advertisers, essentially, that women are the experts in consumption. Right, and the way they put this across is, I remember an ad for Jif peanut butter, and the reason I remember it is because it's so obnoxious, and maybe that's what they were trying to do, but who knows. But what you have is this woman in the supermarket, and she's looking through all the packages of soap, and then she knowledgeably chooses the right, presumably the right brand of soap, and she puts that in her shopping cart, and then she goes over to the peanut butter and she takes this scuzzy brand of peanut butter off the rack, and another woman comes along and says, well, you knew the right kind of soap to buy for your family, didn't you? And she said, well, yes, of course. And then so the other woman said, well, but then shouldn't you use the right brand of peanut butter? And the other woman, of course, was totally horrified because she'd been attacked where she lived, right in the peanut butter. And she said, I don't know any difference. Oh, you know, it's terrible. And so then they did the thing where they opened the jars and you taste this one and taste that one. Yes, Jif smells like real peanut butter or something. And then she goes off with her jar of Jif peanut butter, right? And once again, the expert in consumerism has triumphed, right? And she will now know once and for all that that is the kind of peanut butter to buy. And she's doing the proper thing for her family. And the other one, which is in the handout, which is another one that I couldn't believe, but it was really great. from the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin, which is a newspaper. More and more, bubble baths are playing a vital role in the rearing of youngsters. Would you believe this? Far from being simply fun or a passing fancy, the bubble bath has become firmly established in family living. Very important, then, to every mother who wants the best for her child is choosing the proper bubble bath products. Right? So you have to find out about peanut butter and bubble bath and all that kind of stuff, and that's very important. Okay, like the thing is, it's funny in a way, right? But it's really sad, too, because what they're doing, it seems to me, is they're manipulating people's needs to feel important, their needs to be able to make some kind of decisions about their lives. And for many women who are isolated for almost all of their lives in their families, this is one of the few areas over which they have some control. As minimal as that control is, whether it's deciding to buy the right kind of peanut butter, it is one of the few things that women do have control over. And so what you see is advertising manipulating people's needs. And that's kind of depressing, to say the least. So my feeling about advertising, which is shared by quite a few people, so I don't feel like I'm really sticking my neck out, is that advertising doesn't create needs, in fact. That what it does is it takes needs that people have and then manipulates them in order to sell products. Another good example, which is a more generalized example, is that of the automobile industry. Now, people need some kind of transportation system. They need to be able to get from A to B. They need to be able to do that in a fairly direct and rapid fashion. And what we have is a situation where we have been led to believe that the automobile is the way to do that, that it is the most efficient, that it is the most comfortable, and on and on and on and on. Now, it is now getting to the point, in fact, where a great many people no longer believe that. But the advertising, the companies don't create the need for transportation. What they create essentially is one way of fulfilling that need, which is to focus it or distort it onto something specific like their own product. You see what I mean? But here again, what's interesting to notice is that as times get tough, as the economic situation gets worse and as people have less and less money to spend, that you have less and less budgeted towards advertising. And the reason is very simple, and it was said by a man named Galbraith, who is a nice economist who sort of hangs around. What he said was, a man who is hungry need never be told of his need for food. And that's essentially it, and that sort of puts advertising in its place. But then the thing is, then does advertising have an effect on us? What does it say to us? If it reinforces stereotypes rather than creating something new, then what are the stereotypes that it presents and reinforces? And maybe we can understand a little bit about why the particular kinds of stereotypes that it presents. I think they present certain stereotypes of women as being passive and nurturant, as being motherly, or as being playthings of one kind or another. They hardly ever show women as working outside of the home, which is an interesting thing. Except I can remember one ad, and it's indicative of the kind of trip that happens. The only ad that I could recall of a woman worker who was featured in an ad, and what it was for Poly Grip or something, and she was complaining that she was a receptionist and her teeth kept falling out of her head, which, you know, makes her then a very sort of amusing figure for everyone to go ho, ho, ho at and sort of thank God for Poly Grip or whatever it was, you know, so that her teeth didn't fall out of her head, but didn't present a particularly positive image of a woman worker. Like, you really wouldn't want to identify with this woman whose teeth were falling out of her head, or at least I didn't really want to do that. So they tend to reinforce our notion that women are homebodies or pets. The only other place, by the way, and there was one slide I just recall in the slideshow that advertises, that includes ads, includes women as women workers in ads, is when they're selling women workers. And it was that ad for The Last Word in Manpower, or in office equipment, right, for Manpower. That's where they show women workers, is when you can buy one. Right, the woman worker as product. So what kinds of things do they show, and what kinds of things essentially are they reflecting about ourselves as women? Well, one of the obvious ones that they show all the time is the sex pot, and it's a really sort of depressing image. And there are great sort of psychological explanations about why they show sex pots. You know, the broad draped over the car, and the theory goes that the guy who buys the car thinks that he will get like an equivalent broad to drape over his car if he has that particular car and all that kind of stuff. And it's a symbol of his masculinity or a status symbol or whatever. Or if you go to Advertising Age or one of the advertising trade magazines, what they say in there is that in order to get people to buy the product, you have to get them to read the ad. In order to get them to read the ad, you have to have them look at the ad. In order to catch their eye so that they'll look at the ad, you put a woman in the ad, because that's one of the things that attracts people's attention most, followed in descending order by dogs and babies. Right? Which is a simpler explanation. And it's sort of interesting that it's concurred in by a great well-known entrepreneur in our city named Dan McLeod, whose rationale for selling some of the papers that he has, which in the past have been objected to rather strenuously by women, his rationale is, tits and ass sell papers. And that's a quote. And that's why I don't like Dan McLeod very much, but that's neither here nor there. In any case, it reinforces these kinds of ads, right? Reinforce the notion of women as sexual objects, as playthings, as certainly not an equivalent person that you would take seriously or that you would debate with or have an intelligent discussion with or whatever. That's not what they're for. They're decorations to a man's life. They're a sort of a symbol of his particular power. Okay, that's one category of ads. Another large category of ads is the mother. And the mother has several different roles. And one of them that I like is the mother who is the healer. And I keep seeing this ad on television, which is for some liniment, right? And her husband comes home and he's had a hard day out on the old tennis courts playing tennis. And of course, she's been looking after the 6 kids at home, but that's neither here nor there. He's had this hard day playing tennis and his arm is sore, right? Oh, ache, pain. And he's groaning. And she comes out with the liniment, right? And she said, "This will do, dear. Just let me rub some of this on." And she goes, rub, 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 rub. And he feels better immediately, of course, which they always do in these ads. And then he looks up at her smiling and he said, "You're a good wife. I think I'll keep you." Isn't that neat? I wonder what would have happened if the liniment didn't work right away. Or, you know, you have the gourmet kind of things, and they play up to that. When they first brought out cake mixes, and they could do the whole thing, right? They could do this powder that everything was in, except you just added the water, and you went stir, 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 plopped it in the pan, and it came up, and it was this beautiful cake. And they found out that women wouldn't buy it. And the reason that they figured out that women wouldn't buy it is because women didn't have any real stake in this cake, right? Nothing of their own creativity. And so what they do now is they make it so that you have to add an egg. And then it becomes your own cake. And you're a gourmet cook, right? It's important. Woman as cook. And woman as expert. And there are millions of the sort of variations on the expert theme. But in any event, these are all essentially women in the home, women doing their traditional role in a traditional fashion. And of course, they're always beautiful and they don't have any creases in their clothes and the baby hasn't thrown up on them. And, you know, like it's really far out in television ads. And then another, almost as an aside, a really neat thing that they do, right, is that they'll use anything to sell stuff. And so what you get, and I vaguely remember seeing them go by in the slideshow, is that they'll even use something like women's liberation to sell stuff, right? And so you find this rash. Well, we saw Liberated Loyalists, which was an ad for Scotch. And there's, what else? Oh, the one with the lady standing on the guy's head for shoes. That was a really good one. And you have like Liberated Candy-Flavored Douche. Right? Oh, that's a nice one. And you have Liberated Perfume, which in which the copy says, "Join the new movement," and I think it was for my sin. And, you know, and you have Liberated Clothes for the Liberated Lady and all that kind of stuff. Generally speaking, I've noticed that with most of the women's liberation ads, these are for essentially what I would call like the hip chick who swings, right? And so they're all in the area of sexuality and they're really sort of heavy into that. And you find a lot of them in magazines like Vogue and really expensive sort of Tony fashion magazines. That's where you get those. But what they don't show, and coming back to that, is they don't show working women. And like the thing that makes that particularly interesting is that if you consider that at any one time in Canada, at least a third of the women who are in the right age range to be in the labor force are in fact working, and that over half of the women in Canada will work at some time in their life in the labor force, it means that in fact, you know, half the women, say, in this room, or more than half the women in this room, will be working women at some point or another. And yet this is one whole area that they avoid showing in ads. Now, it's, you know, has to be purely speculative, but why don't they show products, you know, sort of advertised by secretaries or by nurses or by teachers or by maids or all those like essentially female occupation type things where you could get the stereotypes and you know, it would all be very cool. And the thing that sort of strikes me is that perhaps what they don't want to do is reinforce the idea of women as workers in the labor force. Now, what they want to reinforce is the idea of the woman as homebody, the idea that women's primary responsibility is to be a wife and to be a mother, that if a woman works, it is in fact only a temporary position, that it is in fact not particularly important to her life. And then you say, well, okay, but what if, in fact, you know, the temporary work lasts for 5 years? Like, that's a lot of not being important to my life, kind of, you know, waste of time. So what are the consequences? I mean, why would this, you know, be something that would be sort of popular as an idea to present to women and to encourage women to think? And the thing that seems to me is that if you have women who believe that their primary function is to go into the home and be wives and mothers, and that their commitment to the labor force is very marginal and very limited, that you have essentially a very docile group of people who are workers. You have a group of people who, for example, will not get involved in any kind of union activity. For the most part, you find that women are very difficult to unionize, very difficult to organize in any way. And one of the reasons is because so many of them see their positions in their jobs as being totally temporary, totally expedient, totally only until next month or next year when I get married and I don't have to do this anymore. And the sad thing is that quite often they do have to do this again and again and again anyway for years and years and years. But the myth persists The number of women who enter the labor force is increasing, but still the myth persists that women's role is in the home. So I guess what we conclude with, or what I conclude with anyway, is that advertising doesn't create needs and values, but what it does is it reinforces and maintains the existing ideological superstructure. And perhaps, and only perhaps, because we really can't prove one way or another what the effects are, but perhaps it's a powerful means of reaffirming over and over that women's place is in the home. And maybe that's the biggest lie of all in advertising. Okay, that's what I think, but I want to know what some of you think. Are there any questions, any comments? There's a mic out there if people want to use it or if you want to just yell.
Well, first of all, I really have to disagree with a lot of what you said.
Good.
You talked about this huge, gigantic labor force that's producing all these goods, right? So we have to consume. It's not the labor force that's producing it. It's the goddamn super rich and the rich that own the means of production. And sure, they're employing people, but damn it, these people have to work in order to eat, in order to survive. And I am really pissed, as part of the working force, that you had the nerve to blame our consumerism on the working force.
No. What I'm trying to say is that the laboring class in this society or any other society produces the wealth. It makes it, right? Now, I'm not saying it gets it. I'm saying it makes it. If it wasn't for people who worked, there would be no wealth.
Yep.
There would be none of any of this. And then if distribution of those goods is only a problem under capitalism, right? I mean, otherwise, we could just give it away. Everybody who needed it would get it. It would be great. Like, I think we're essentially arguing the same point, and maybe I wasn't clear enough.
Yeah. And the other thing is you talk about advertising as, I mean, you've told us, okay, this is what advertising does. It makes us consume. It reinforces, gives us the answer to our needs, so to speak. Like, we know that. And, you know, how do you, like, abolish advertising or the kind of advertising that you're talking about? We all came here knowing exactly what advertising does, what it means. What I came for, in a sense, was like some answers. How do you, like, rationally fight this need? This thing that the advertisers instill in you. Like, you know, what do you do about it? Do you just sit and laugh and say, okay, I'm not going to buy? Is that what you do?
Okay, like, in some senses, I feel like I've just been asked, how do you make the revolution? And I really don't feel quite up to it. But there are some sort of general things that I feel, and you can argue about it, that it is only a very limited and very personal solution to not buy certain kinds of things. Like, it's been a part of the sort of value system, I think, of the counterculture and also of students to get by on as little as possible and to, you know, do the whole Salvation Army rummage sale routine and recycling of stuff and not throwing anything away. And I think that's only a limited kind of action that people can do, like on an individual or even small group level. I don't think that's an answer. But the thing is, like, I don't think advertising will go away, and I don't think that the kinds of things that they are doing can be substantially changed without, in fact, a total revamping of the economic system, because it is part and parcel of the economic system. And I think there are more fundamental things that one would attack rather than advertising. Although, as a way of drawing people's attention to certain kinds of situations, I can see sort of media attacks as having some value. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, I didn't mean to sound like really hostile, but it's like,
that's all right.
You know, we've been sitting here, you know, and it's like you feel really helpless because, like, okay, you talk about going to Salvation Army and buying, but is that really an alternative? I mean, we give to Salvation Army, and then they charge us back for the stuff, right? So is that really any better?
And they also charge some people, or try and charge so much that that people can, in fact, the very poor people can't afford to buy at the Salvation Army, which has to be an incredible contradiction.
You know, and it's like you're really put in a bind because, like, you, you know, how do you select? You know, like, do you, where do you start your boycott? Do you boycott Standard Oil but buy from Texaco when you have to buy gas for your car? I mean, it's like, here you are as a consumer, and you're going to have to consume some things.
Yeah.
Be it food or, you know, whatever. And, like, where do you go? I mean, in order sort of not to support the system.
In a, like, that's essentially going behind the advertising, right? Because it's not so much that you attack it from the point of view that they, that this particular service or these kinds of things aren't available and why aren't you advertising them, right? But simply that they aren't available and that you have to take that kind of battle to the government. But, you know, yeah, that's an excellent point. But, like, okay, the only other thing about, you know, that struck me while you were raising the last point about who do you buy from, it seems to me that it, to a limited extent also, consumer boycotts, as difficult as they are to undertake and as time-consuming and all the rest of it, can have at least a limited effect in gaining some kind of measure of dignity for some workers. Like, the great workers' boycott, which after five long years was finally more or less successful. And I would draw people's attention to the craft boycott, which the National Farmers Union is now trying to organize on a nationwide basis, which is to say that craft, I don't know, there are probably people here who know more about it than I do, but basically it seems that craft is the largest buyer of cheese and dairy products, particularly in the province of Ontario, that the milk farmers are attempting to gain recognition of the farmers' union as a bargaining agent so that food prices can, for the first time in God knows, come under some kind of control, that the farmers, in fact, will get a larger proportion of what now goes essentially as profit to corporations like Kraft. They've deliberately taken on the largest corporation in this field, and what they're asking people right across the country to do is to boycott all Kraft products. And since there are, you know, okay, then you're in the bind, then you have to buy somebody else's, and it also means you can't buy cream cheese anymore because I don't know anybody else who makes it. But there was a recipe in the grape for making your own cream cheese, so if you're really an addict, you can always do that. And perhaps at least in that particular situation, that's a way of making some kind of sense out of the stuff that you do actually have to buy.